So if you didn't notice from the readings, the theme is hate. That's strange for many reasons. The first is, I think the hatred that we experience it if we experience is most often dealt with by way of suppression. We suppress hate. So to explicitly discuss it is already going against, I think, our norms, our normal way of behaving. But I wanted to do so in part because Tim's sermon last week was on love. And I think a lot of what will be said today, if put in conversation with what Tim had to say, will be mutually illuminating. So what Tim had to say about love should be put in relief by what I have to say about hate. Having said that, let me make one methodological comment. Please interrupt, like many of you did last time. Neil gave a sermon here. That was really wonderful. I'd love to hear a story that something I say arises within you. Just let me know. I'll stop. Or more importantly, much more importantly, stop me if I say something that doesn't make sense. It's going to happen often, and you won't stop me very often, which is sad, but I do encourage it. I'll even stop myself occasionally. So I want to organize my thoughts today around the passion versus affect character of hate. I thought there was a very interesting distinction that the first philosopher we read made. If hate is a passion, and let us assume it is, and it's one that we are bold enough to admit that we undergo experience, then we should ask, what are the affects associated with it? Most often, it is anger. But I think there are three others, and I think they relate to interesting ways that Christianity speaks to hate, or the affects associated with hate. So just as a schematic point, I'll say that the four affects associated with the passion of hate are anger, a feeling of disgust, a feeling of disvaluation, evaluating negatively, I mean, and finally, an affect of fear, especially fear of otherness. And I think there's something to be said about each of these from what the teachings of Christ have to say. This was a very strange passage from the Gospel of Luke. The word certainly is hate, and it is unique to Luke that Jesus there says you must hate your family. So anyway, let's talk about the first kind of affect, which is disgust. Often when I hate something, when I experience a feeling of hate, the object of hatred arises this almost immediate, unspeakable feeling of hate. One can think of the feeling that cockroaches create. I don't hate cockroaches, and I don't hate snakes, but some people do. If you're such a person, just imagine that disgust that hate for that animal creates in you. This is the sort of hate that is to be absolutely overcome. The teachings of love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. This is a sort of hate that is the contrary of the love that is to be cultivated, according to Jesus' teaching. And this sort of hate is, I think, the basis of misogyny, bigotry, racism. It's not a principle of hate. It's a feeling within one's gut of disgust at this other race, this other sex, this other class of people, ethnic or whatever. I take that as more, yeah, please.
Is it an instinctual hate? Is it an instinctual feeling?
Yeah, you know, I specifically didn't say that because I didn't want to be biologistic. Like, I don't want to say it's an anthropological basis, and so we know from evolutionary, but yes, it might as well be, I don't know. Yeah, it's possible that we have an instinct to hate or to feel disgust at certain things. In this case, theology has to overcome biology, if that's the case. Anyway, I'm not going to spend much. Yeah, please.
I'm sorry. Haven't some of these categories been defined a little bit more recently than since, like, there are a lot of theories about how race is a construct?
Yeah.
The idea of, like, for example, the white race is pretty recent. So, in that regard, I find it hard to believe that this palpable disgust, I find it hard to believe that racism has a biological basis.
Yeah, so that's why I didn't want to get into that kind of thing. You're exactly right. Race is a construct, we can agree on that. To be racist is to engage in the imaginary exercise of constructing that other that you hate. So the point is less that, I just really hate French people as much as I have a feeling of disgust and it attaches to certain objects, like French people. I don't hate French people. They are the worst customers at cafes, though. That's, yeah.
I think to be clear, like, when I say instinctual, I think I'm thinking more of it arising out of fear. And so it being a response based on emotion like fear.
No, I'm glad you said that.
So,
yeah. That's good, that helps me clarify the point. The four affects that I've detailed, it's a conceptual game. All of these blend together all the time. It's for the artificial sake of organizing some thoughts and trying to be more clear about the different affects that I think do attach to the passion of hate. The reason I say I didn't want to talk about the other here is because that comes up when I talk about fear. And that's more conceptual. That's more like actually identifying and knowing an enemy and hating that enemy rather than this immediate, again, visceral. I just think of like the feeling that my stomach has when it turns at seeing a wound. One time I saw a baseball player slide into a base with his foot and it just went like this. Okay? That was there was no, I don't know why. Why would I tell you that?
To give us that feeling.
That's what I'm talking about, the gut feeling, if you will, rather than actually fearing someone you've defined. So instinct is good in that sense, because we think of instincts as somehow preconscious or preconceptual. I just want to avoid the biology, anthropology, and business. In any case, let's just assume that everyone agrees that that's bad. We shouldn't hate based on disgust. So there's another sort of visceral, preconceptual element to hate in its effectual component, not just disgust and not just devaluation and fear, there's also anger. And this sort of anger, I think, actually is where we get much more interesting in the discussion. I think anger actually has a place in Jesus's teaching. One can imagine absolutely most poignantly right now, the anger, and even to the point of hate, we could say, that's being experienced by so many in Baltimore. The question is, could there be a proper place for the anger associated with hate in the teachings of Jesus? And I think the answer is yes. Hate is in some sense appropriate there. And in the Bible, especially in the Hebrew Bible, where the hatred of God is most often discussed, it's just this, the anger at wrongdoing, at lawlessness, at, if you like, sin. Didn't we discuss, that was one of the words, right? Yeah. So hatred directed towards sin. I think this one is a bit more self-evident. I just want to mention it in passing. Righteous indignation, if you like, better than hate, I think is something that needs to be admitted, that we have, that we experience, that we undergo, and in a certain sense cultivated. A certain awareness of the evil and suffering that the world knows. And so a really soft love that can't tolerate anger is just not interesting, not interesting at all. And that's why Peirce's, the second reading, his comments were so fascinating. It's hate as a defect of love, as an imperfect stage on the way to the realization of love. It's a radical idea. What the implications are, I don't want to get into, because you've already been subjugated to any number of digressions like this one happening right now. But the point is that there's something there. Okay, so if there's disgust, and if there's anger, and if these exist on a certain immediate level, a visceral level, a gut level, I think there are two more affects associated with hatred. And these are the more difficult, the more controversial, and the place where I get my title for the sermon, which is, by the way, in order to love life, I hate life. It's a strange title. So back to the affects. The third is devaluation. This is where you recognize that which you hate and regard it lesser, lower, not worthy. And I think this is familiar. Does anyone have a hate story? Here would be a great, great point just to be honest and be like, yeah, one time.
I hate haters.
Nice.
Like people who are kind of their default mode is to find the negative or the, you know, the, like, and you run into a lot of these people, say in grad school context, people who have cultivated
right.
their critical faculty a lot. They're really good at finding out what's wrong. You know, I think a lot of us who went to community school or seminary went there in part because we wanted to exercise that muscle, but also we wanted to exercise the muscle, like the spirituality muscle, the muscle of like going deeper in faith or in learning how to love more. And so I think a common story that I heard and one that I went through sometimes was that hate, that kind of devaluation, finding the flaw in something, overriding the other stuff. And I heard a lot of people struggle with that.
Yeah, that's a great example, not only because you just redoubled hate, which I love, hating hate, but it leads to the example that I was thinking of. The sort of hate here that might be appropriate is to behave in such a way that out of love you appear hateful. To behave in such a way that out of love you appear hateful.
Is that like tough love?
That's a good question. I don't know if tough love is quite enough. One could imagine if you believed in corporal punishment, for example, that in order to love your child, you need to spank the child. But I think it may be much more radical than that. I think of a historical example. My favorite philosopher that resonates very deeply within my soul is Soren Kierkegaard. Nice. Still louder? Okay. So he was a Danish thinker who lived in the 19th century in Copenhagen. And he did a lot of funny things. He used to walk around Copenhagen and accost people. Like they avoided him in the street because you would get in a conversation with him and he would just beat you down with words because he was an animal. He had a young lover, I think she was 14, the times were different, named Regina Olsen. And they had a really solid relationship, a great deal of love for one another. For some reason he had a premonition or if you like, a revelation from God, that this relationship could not be. And so what he did is he went to Germany to study with some well-known philosophers, not quite Hegel, but Schilling, I believe it was. And part of the reason he did that was not only was it a European tradition to leave your home country and go study, say, in Germany, but to get away from Regina. But he took a very, very specific approach, an approach that we know only from his journals. So he's not known in his lifetime. What he did is, in order to break off this relationship because he heard a divine no, was he convinced her to hate him. he treated her very poorly. Her brother threatened to kill him, Soren, and their family entreated him, "Why are you behaving this way?" And the reason was, at least in his mind, more than tough love, but in order to be loving, you have to suffer being hated. In other words, out of an excess of love to appear as hateful. So we can think of another example where this might be true in principle or on the level of a concept and not just tough love as a parenting approach. Imagine light and an excess of light, a flash, a bang, if you like. What happens? In an excess of light, it appears for people with certain capacities as darkness. When light is so bright, it blinds you. Perhaps just so when love sometimes is so great, it appears as hate, its opposite. Here, all kinds of speculative theories about the creation of the world could come to the table. Why could there be a God who created the world and so much evil and suffering? Well, it's possible that God, out of an excess of love, also chose to appear as hateful. Now, since it's speculative, I don't really want to waste time on it, but the only thing is that perhaps it could be that this devaluation, this affective devaluation, the way that Regina regarded Soren, perhaps that could be something that really does happen. Perhaps there's a time where an excess of love appears as hatred.
Hey, Patrick.
Please.
I take issue with that because I think the Jesus
nice.
Message. I don't think it's necessarily not true that love and hate can be confused. But I also think that in a religious context, justifying anger and hatred and devaluation as love has been a justification for a lot of men who abuse women. It's been a justification for a lot of controlling behavior and domestic violence, and so that's.
Yeah, that's good. You know, I did neglect to mention that not only are the thoughts that I'm trying to develop here with you now. There's a great Kleist. He was a contemporary of Goethe. He wrote this essay called "On the Gradual Formation of Thoughts, Wilt Speaking." That's what's happening now. I mean, I have like a lot of no. That's why. I don't know. I didn't want to read that. But I did neglect to mention, yes, there's a certain danger associated with thinking and talking about hate. And that's why suppression is such a common strategy for dealing with hate. But perhaps also bringing it out in the fore is, and thinking it through, diagnosing it, is a way to not only not suppress, but to deal with some of its sort of volcanic characteristics of just erupting. Having said that, it might also be like suicide. Suicide is a funny animal in that when some people commit suicide and it gets publicized, more people tend to do so. That's a risk. I don't know if hate is something we can diagnose, think through, talk about, or if it's like suicide, where even the mere mention of it causes to spread a little bit. So anyway, you're right. The other thing I would say is talking about the four different affects associated with this passion is a way to unhinge hate, that passion, where it's appropriate from those affects. So though hate has an effectual opponent of anger, that isn't to condone actual feelings of anger. I mean, that's obviously not a healthy way to live. This feeling of devaluation, that can't possibly be used as a justification for hitting women or for telling women that they need to stay with abusive husbands. But what do you think? Should you say something more? Okay. Thank you guys so much for interrupting. So, having said that, disgust, anger, devaluation, and finally, fear. This is probably the most controversial aspect of some of the thoughts that I want to share with you. It relates to the gospel passage that Katie read. In order to save your life, you have to hate your life. The words self-hatred don't appear there, but it's clearly something like not only a condoning of self-hatred, but a recommendation of self-hatred. This is a very strange thing. I should say, if I recommend self-hatred to you, it's not a psychological fact. It's not a recommendation that you start to feel loathing within yourself. Hi, how are you doing? Welcome. I'm talking about self-hatred right now. So if we're already talking about hate and we're not interested in simply suppressing it, if we're not so soft in the depth and profundity of love to be afraid to talk about hate, then could there be a meaning for self-hatred? And here, I think it would be appropriate to read a quote. I'm going to read from Blaise Pascal. He's great. He was a French mathematician and philosopher. He lived at the time of Descartes, and he says here, God has created man with two loves, the love of God and the love of self. Yet with this law that the love of God shall be infinite, that is to say, with no end other than God, God's self, and that the love of self shall be finite and leading back to God. With the coming of sin, man has lost the first of these loves, the love of God. And since the love of self has remained alone in this great soul, which is capable of infinite love, this self-love has spread and overflowed into the vacuum which the love of God has left. And thus he has loved himself and all things for himself, that is to say, infinitely. So the sort of philosophical backdrop here is a belief in egoism, the fact that I love myself always and forever, such that it's, in a certain sense, impossible not to love myself. This sort of, if we talk about biology, this would be like the need to not only perpetuate, but to stay in existence, to always be striving to survive. And whether that's the case or not, I think it's a powerful idea. And in any case, it happens all the time. We do love ourselves. And we love ourselves, I think, to the point of fearing what is other to ourselves. And here's the fourth affect, the fear of what is other. Is it possible that we do need to learn how to hate ourselves insofar as we have a self that is incapable of loving others because it fears others? If there was such a self like that, then it's possible that self deserves hatred. But what would that mean? What would that mean? That's the question. If it's not going to be a psychological concept of just loathing your own body, for example, if it's not a matter of feeling too fat or too thin or too stupid, then what is it? I think it's possible that it's the strength and the courage to see the hatred that is actually implicit, is actually happening under the skin that we experience. The boldness to look at ourselves in a way that sees that we already do hate ourselves, hate a certain self. And if that's the case, then Neil's comment about hating haters is all the more apropos. Because self-hatred in that case would be to hate the hatred, to hate the self that hates itself. So there are a lot of pieces in play. I am recommending, perhaps, to hate yourself. But the recommendation is to hate yourself in order to love yourself. And that happens because I think we already hate ourselves. And in order to hate ourselves, then we hate that self that is hated, in order to be forgiven, in order to love. So what self is it that we hate? Is it the self that hates others? That's the self that needs to be hated. That isn't the self that I think we always hate. Sometimes it is the self that isn't smart enough. It is the self that feels overweight. But that's foolish. What needs to be hated is the self that hates others. But there's one more subtlety to the trick here. It's also possible that that self that fears others and loves itself can do nothing but love itself. That's another quote from Pascal. Let me read to you. Is it possible to do anything but love yourself? This is again from Ms. Pensées. We ought to hate ourselves and everything which drives us to become attached to anything but God alone. But he says, as we cannot love what is outside us, we must love a being who is within us, but not ourselves. And I think there's something to that. If it's possible to hate ourselves as well as love ourselves, that could mean that from within we're already divided. And what's the division? Is it possible that it's God already living within us? Is it possible that in some way this other that we are afraid of is already living within us? The language that we speak that was given to us, that has formed us, that we think in, that has literally colonized our mind, is it possible that that's an other already in us? Yes, Allison?
I just have a story coming to mind.
Thank you.
A passage where I don't agree with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always rubbed me the wrong way. When I was in like fifth grade, I would say, my mom got saved. And before that, we weren't particularly religious. I mean, we went to church, especially on like Easter and Christmas. But then she had a dream that like she felt called her to become a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a marked difference in the way that she interacted at home now, where she was serving God's people and not as much our family. And at the time, somehow, so we were evangelical, so I had to read the Bible a lot.
Yeah.
And I remember coming across this passage and being like, Jesus, like, you're the worst. Like,
yeah.
The worst teaching ever, what a terrible idea. Like, I want my mom back,
you
know? And I think this type of love and this way of teaching is dangerous. Like, I think there's no problem with loving your sister and your mom and your brother and your daughter and your son and yourself. I think there's a place for that kind of love. Within this larger context of loving that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't know how it fits in, but I feel like that's like a piece of the puzzle of Jesus' teaching that I don't agree with.
Yeah.
And so I can't like make sense of how that fits into what you're teaching this morning. Like, if I have already started that from my mind, it's hard for me to fit it in this morning. And I always felt bad like disagreeing with Jesus. But, you know, I think, like, why not love your family?
Yeah.
And why not start from that point? I don't know.
That's good. I do have a couple thoughts on that. Go ahead. It's boring.
So I was raised Buddhist, and it actually kind of reminds me a lot about some of the reasons that I'm not Buddhist anymore, but... You know, the idea of the things that you love
mm-hmm.
being the things that tie you to this reality, which inevitably will cause you to suffer.
Right.
So to end that suffering, you let go of that love, and that is what saves you from the suffering.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Simone Weil also talks about a certain self-hatred, and she agrees with that teaching. And she says, finally, the only thing that you have is yourself. And so if the demand of love is sacrifice, then you have to sacrifice yourself. But it's possible that you get yourself back having sacrificed yourself. That's the claim. So in Jesus' teaching, if you imagine not only on the one hand hating your family, but loving your enemies, then you alienate yourself from your family by hating them. In other words, you turn them into the enemy, which means now they need to be loved, but from a different perspective, from the perspective of the infinite love of God. And I think the value of that, so this is, no one does that, by the way. But the value of that teaching is immense. You had your mom there to love growing up. Many don't have families like that at all. And to include them in the family of God is the beauty of that teaching. That finally your mother is not the person that you love, but you love just whoever is near you. Whoever happens to wander within your proximity, that's who you love. Yeah, that's the other thing. You know, Jesus clearly has disciples who are grown men. You know, his disciples are not children. So the sort of appropriateness of hating your family is a teaching from Jesus. What Jesus didn't even pass his teachings on. You know, that happened to be his followers. So I agree completely. Yeah.
One thing, because I've always struggled with that too, and I tried to make sense of it, and it's like, no, I just won't think about it.
Yeah.
The one place where it started to maybe have some meaning for me was, and this is bad because that's my wife who's talking and I'm a minister, but is when Jesus dies on the cross. In at least one of the Gospels, his mother's there. The one he's, you know, at another point he's like, hey, I'm helping these people right now. His mother's there, and he points to one of his disciples, and he says, she's your mom now. Take care of her. And that's when it started to be like disrupting the exclusivity.
Yeah.
Was not to devalue her. It didn't mean he loved her or his family less, but there was something about it that allowed someone who's not biologically related to her at all later to become her son. And something about that detaching to, yeah, I haven't thought through it in exactly your terms, which are challenging, but does that make sense? There was something in that, the same movement allowed for this very unusual, intense thing that happened afterwards.
Yeah,
I would just say to that, carrying your child right now, that
I'm not trying to.
I don't think I could have imagined before now the deep loss.
Well, and I think it's important to know that, as Patrick was saying, Jesus' followers were men. He didn't have a societal expectation to care for that family. And so, I don't know, I take issue with most of the philosophers you're talking about, because they're all privileged white men.
Yes.
Or dead.
Well, yeah. Gary?
And I just wanted to, Alice really affirms.
Pregnancy hormone.
But it's also very real. And yeah. I have a mother that was exactly like that. And her life was for the church, and we were kind of along for the ride. And I think that the thing that's lost in that is that when, you know, you can get so caught up in this is what I'm doing for God, that you lose sight of what actually God might actually be wanting you to do. You're a mother, and these are your children. And
I think what's making me cry is the thought of Mary losing Jesus. Mm-hmm. But she doesn't want at that moment another son. She wants Jesus, you know? That's it.
So I think that's exactly the point, is this question of hate is only makes sense in light of an infinite and absolute demand. Finally, what do you believe in? The infinite love of God? And like Per said, the love of God that exists for everyone to the point that even your life is at stake? It's that demand only makes sense, by the way, from a certain level of development, not being a child, a certain level of health, not being of unsound mind. And then this sense of hating everything except the love of God, finally that, in that perspective, it becomes clear for the first moment. But it's a hate in service of love. And that's the point. Sorry, you?
I'm just going to say that hate and love are just really bound together. And I heard that in the readings. They're bound together and they're not opposites. And Mary would hate the moment and what was happening to Jesus. She would have hated that moment. And she would have hated it that he said, he's down.
Yeah.
He wouldn't, she wouldn't.
Yeah.
That's because she loved him.
Yeah.
Bound to it, just really bound.
What goes on? So did anyone have any, thank you, any other thoughts? We're really, Yeah?
I guess one thing that I kind of think of in trying to make sense of the Bible passage, which, like, I totally hear, most of me, like, agrees with where people are coming from, where it's like, no, you love your family, and that's good to love your family. But also just sort of thinking about, like, my own experience growing up. I mean, my family's great. I'm from, like, a town that's, like, pretty privileged, and like children are almost like projects. Like there's something very masturbatory about family, like where it's like
just raising a child up.
A lot of like parents trying to channel their like ambitions and egos through children.
Yeah.
And it's this weird love hate thing where it's like you're so great, just go be special. And I know I'm like really fortunate to be from a place where like children are told they're special and like are supposed to go feel special, etc. But I can sort of understand a little bit of that statement of like, yeah, your family isn't everything. There's a broader world, and your kids are great. They're also little jerks sometimes too, because you know we're humans. So that's like one thing I think of when I hear that.
Right. I mean, the family is your identity. It's where you already are, and from that place is fear of what's other to that. And so I think it's right that this message of Jesus elicits disagreement or unsettling feelings. But that's the point, is to be challenged by this, you know, prophet of God. Is he a prophet of God? He's supposed to be. If it's comfortable to you to hear that message, then you precisely haven't heard the message. And so, you know, trying to organize passion and affect in these four different ways, encouraging reflection, at least on the thought of self-hatred, that's what I'm interested in. I don't yet understand the teachings here of Christ, but I'm interested in doing so. I'm challenged to do so, and perhaps this way of organizing some thoughts is helpful. Anyway, yeah.
Just one final note. Two things that are kind of coming up. One, sort of like on a everyday level, I know for myself sometimes this word, the actual word of hate, becomes so normalized in how you conversate and speak about certain things in your life, like, oh, I hate this or I hate that, and so I've been challenging myself to really, you know, be a little bit more choice with the words that I describe in terms of my response to things that happen in my life, because I think that word hate does carry a lot of weight with it. And then just, Patrick, to your point, thinking more about the sort of reconciliation and the journey of working with hate as a mean, as a means towards, you know, this eventual place of love, I think is kind of a note, you know, to take and walk with.
Definitely. A hate that embraces, or a love that embraces hate, it's a profound thought.